Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. According to the Association of American Publishers, last year, for the first time, e-books garnered more revenue than any other format of adult fiction. Overall, net sales revenue for electronic books more than doubled in 2011 compared to 2010, and there's every reason to believe that transition will continue here in 2012 and then beyond. Meanwhile, the industry has felt the effects of the bankruptcy and closures of Borders stores nationwide, another signal of a rapidly changing industry. As more people download novels to their Kindles and Nooks, what's to become of the publishing industry? Could we see a day when actual physical books are no longer printed? Is what's happening with the newspaper and magazine industries, the shift from daily and weekly publications to primarily online services, a harbinger of things to come for books? Could we see a day when bookstores and libraries are filled with file servers, but no books? To discuss trends in today's publishing industry, we're joined by two guests. Dominique Rocca is founder, publisher, and CEO of Source Books, an independent publisher based in Naperville, Illinois. She is the immediate past chair of the Book Industry Study Group. Dominique Rocca, welcome to Focus.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks for joining us. And also with us is Amanda Gomm, co-founder of Digital Bindery, based in Portland, Oregon. It's a company that provides digital conversion services for both publishers and authors. Amanda, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Glad to have you with us. As we begin our discussion, we welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome your questions on our Facebook page, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is willpublicmedia. Dominique, what, if anything, is happening to the publishing industry? Is there any sense of whether there are actual and potentially permanent declines in the sales of books?
No, actually, the data is unequivocal at this point. I think that book sales are actually increasing. By that, I mean specifically that the unit sales of titles is going up. People are buying more books, and that's kind of not surprising because in the past, we saw that about 5% of Americans went into a bookstore in an average year. But with the ubiquity or the growing trend in device adoption, you're seeing more and more people buying books on their devices, whether that be a phone or that be an iPad or people actually reading on their laptops.
So there is this shift from print to e-books, but it's not hurting the industry, in your mind at least.
Well, I think it's transforming the industry. And it, you know, one of the things that's very different about book publishing and that we don't really talk about very much is how diverse the industry is. You know, it's not like music. So the industry is not transforming uniformly. You know, e-textbooks are going to look differently than children's picture books, which are going to look different than novels, which are going to look different than professional books for lawyers, right?
Right. Amanda, it's not just major publishing houses that are seeing this transformation. I mean, I take it you have individual authors seeking your assistance to turn their works into e-books?
Absolutely. The independent authors now, they are considering going digital only, and I know some larger publishing houses as well consider, instead of putting out the print book, just going digital. So we see some of that happening, and the ability for the independent author to reach a wider audience is having a lot of impact on who we're seeing buying books and selling books and all kinds of things. So definitely independent authors are definitely going digital.
Dominique, you mentioned the music industry, and you say that what's happening with books is different from what happened with music downloads. And yet, isn't there somewhat of a similarity in that readers seem generally willing to fork over money for e-books in a way that maybe in other industries they're not, like magazines or newspapers?
Oh, interesting. Yes, that's true, that people are willing to pay for e-books, but you're also seeing pricing drop on books, right? And that's been a whole conversation in our industry as the, you know, it's kind of interesting. We used to have in printed books, and we still have in printed books, we have, you know, a hardcover book and then a trade paperback book and then a mass market book. And that was kind of the evolution of the book, right? You would start a big author on a hardcover and then you would move them, you know, gradually into paper, and the pricing would shift down as you did that. But of course, in ebooks, a hardcover and a trade paper are the same, right? You can't tell the difference. So that changes the game as well.
So what does that mean then for authors who, you know, within this industry, if their books were, you know, selling for a certain amount of money in hardcover and then a lesser amount in softcover, I imagine they'd see some percentage of that over time.
I think that this is one of the parts of our transformation that has authors, agents, and the industry as a whole concerned, right? Because, you know, if it is the case that e-books are in fact, and I think I made this argument 3 years ago, but you know, if in fact e-books are a form of mass market product, right? So a very cheap form of product, then we're gonna take a large chunk of revenue out of the industry as a whole. And in that sense, for fiction, it will look a lot like music.
What, if anything, do you see the book publishing industry having in common with magazines and newspapers?
Well, we're very different from magazines and newspapers. You know, the partly because it's less news, less immediacy driven, right? So Harry Potter probably maybe not as valuable as the day it came out, but still of great value. Whereas any magazine article that was published during that year, probably hard to find, I would bet.
Amanda, do you think magazines maybe miscalculated making so much content available online for free for so long? Is that maybe a distinction between magazines and book publishing?
I think that's one of the distinctions that, you know, with that not having that paywall up for so much information. And with, I think there's a similar thing happening when we're talking about the price of ebooks. When the price keeps dropping, we have to compete with content that's available for free, and we have to put out more value so that, you know, there is a drive to continue to pay for that. And I think, like Dominique was saying, we are seeing people that do value that longer form and that stuff coming together and being presented in one piece. But yeah, I think we're seeing a similar kind of competition with free or very inexpensive content.
So what is ultimately happening with this industry? Is it sort of a dichotomy where, what we see, you know, physically in the world is that stores like Borders close down, you know, and maybe there are fewer bookstores and less of a need, perhaps, maybe less demand for physical books as there's a greater demand for electronic. But is it creating a healthier industry, do you both think? Amanda?
I think that we're going through a very similar period to what happened when the printing press was first invented, and we're still kind of trying to figure out the technical aspects of how to present all of this traditional publishing stuff that we know, the science of reading, and how to bring that, all of that, the aesthetic and the beauty and all that into the ebook, and also from the technical standpoint, being able to do what we need to do to present the material so that more people will feel comfortable reading digitally. And so I think the industry is, like Dominique was saying, everyone's sort of going in their own path to this digital place. And the path for children's books is very different than the path for a textbook. And so I think it's forcing everybody to, at first we all panicked, and now we all have to get a digital book out, and everybody's going ebook, and what do we do? And now we're kind of trying to take a breath and figure out how to actually present really good, high-quality stuff that we've been working on since, you know, the 1500s, and present that in a way that we have some integrity to our tradition.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. My guests are Dominique Rocca, founder, publisher, and CEO of Source Books, an independent publisher based in Naperville. She's the immediate past chair of the Book Industry Study Group, and Amanda Gom, co-founder of Digital Bindery in Portland, Oregon, a digital conversion service provider for publishers and authors. We're discussing the future of the publishing industry, books in particular, amid a continuing transition towards more ebook sales. In light of struggles that daily newspapers and weekly magazines have had, Newsweek's transition online, more papers reducing or eliminating their print editions and so forth, we were curious what the future might look like for books. And this is a particularly relevant discussion to have considering a local connection to this topic. The late Michael Hart of Urbana, who founded Project Gutenberg, which was in essence the precursor to today's ebooks. We'd like to know what you think. Are you spending more or less money on books today? Are you only purchasing ebooks? Are you purchasing hard copies? Can you envision a day when we only ever download books to e-readers like Kindles and Nooks instead of purchasing a physical copy? We welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. Dominique, I think you wanted to say something right before I stepped in there.
Yes. Well, first of all, you know, will the print book go away? No. That's a very, you know, it's a quick answer on that. You can see the data that we have on things like children's picture books or on photography books or, you know, illustrated cookbooks. You know, we don't have yet a good transformation for those kinds of books. But probably that leads to sort of the second point, which is that we are at the first wave of this transformation. Like Amanda said, you know, the exact replica of the physical version of the book. What interests me and the things that I've been working on for the last 3 or 5 years is the promise of digital books beyond that first wave. So what do we do? How do we make books more interactive, more social, more personal, smarter? And there's a lot of work going on in that field that, you know, that is really going to revolutionize how we even think about books. So when you think about the future of the book, you're not thinking about the future of the book as you once knew it. You're talking about the future of the book that is a completely new object.
Amanda, what do you think? Can you envision a future when we're not physically publishing books anymore?
No, I agree with Dominique. I think when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail kind of idea, where we think that if we're in digital publishing, that we need to digitally publish everything, and that's the best tool. But, you know, it's just like as we progress toward enhanced ebooks or books that look more like apps, there are bells and whistles we can add that will really help in some of the learning that we do when we read, but then sometimes it just gets in the way of the experience. When we think of a parent reading to a child and we think of that experience, it's intimate and it's reading and it's not play in a large sense of the word, but you know, when we start adding buttons and songs and all kinds of things, we're getting in the way of that experience. So we're struggling. And I think we're heading in the right direction to use the bells and whistles when they're appropriate and to pull them back when they're not. And I agree, you know, when we look back at when print first started, we were trying really hard to replicate that calligraphy, and we thought that that was what a book was this handwritten, beautiful, illuminated manuscript. And we progressed through that, and we got to the point where we can create books that are easier to read, that aren't so fatiguing on the eye, and so now we're all able to read, and I think we're going that same kind of place where we think we know what a book is, but we don't yet, and we're still kind of going through this evolution.
Well, Amanda, for centuries, reading was this intimate experience between the reader and the writer. There wasn't anybody else involved. It wasn't interactive. There weren't hyperlinks. There were footnotes maybe occasionally to look up, but not, you know, the difference seems to be that with ebooks, you could just very easily find yourself sort of wavering from the story into, you know, well, let me click on this link, which will take me to this page. And then all of a sudden I'm not really reading anymore.
Well, and I think I would challenge that and say that you are still reading and you're still learning through text or whatever experience you're doing. And so the idea of reading is going to change a little bit, that it's not just going to be a static experience, but it still can be, and it's still you and the information. I think when we are talking about reading to learn, we're talking about a different thing than when we're reading to be entertained or have that sort of very internal experience. And so I think both things will still be available for people. And I think that's the thing about digital books, is that we have the opportunity to do more. We can be far more accessible. We don't have to wait anymore for the large print version to come out. We can make the print larger, and we can do that. And ebooks are better at that. So, you know, there are places where ebooks are better, and there are places where they're not quite there yet. But I think we're going to get to the point where we're at least on parity with print and digital books.
Dominique, one of the arguments in favor of maintaining physical books, at least to some degree, going forward, is this notion of a tactile sensation, of holding a physical book versus holding a Kindle or a Nook or some other e-reader. How important is that tactile sensation in the reading experience?
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't seen any information on that. I will, though, go back to something you said, Craig, that I think is really important, which is the idea of leaving the story, right? So sometimes when we have links or we have bells and whistles, we actually take you out of the story and make the story, and then you have to find a way to come back to the story. But today I think we're really all working on starting with the reader experience. So what is it that you're experiencing? How do we get you actually to immerse better in the story rather than taking you in and out of it?
Well,
a lot of the work that's being done in transmedia, for example, is actually about that.
Well, to that end, I want to read a quote to both of you and get your reaction to it. This is from former independent publisher Richard Ian Nash, and he discussed this particular issue with David Henry Steria, a blogger for the Huffington Post. This is just this past summer. Nash suggested the future of book publishing lies not just in the books themselves, but in, quote, an imprint that will produce books in traditional ways, but will also do limited editions, enhanced electronic editions, workshops, speaking engagements, access to exclusive content, retreats, add-ons, which give passionate fans the opportunity to do more than just buy a book from a writer. What do you think of this concept, and shouldn't the... go ahead.
Yeah, well, I know Richard. He's a friend, and he has made that argument, and I think it's a very interesting one, and you can see people doing this. So what that's about is really working within a very defined vertical. So Richard, for example, worked within a very clear type of novel, and you can get all of those fans around... all those different experiences, right? So they're going to be interested in seeing that author and perhaps having a limited edition of that author, all of those different kinds of ways of interacting with that content makes sense if you've got a fairly uniform audience. The problem of trade book publishing as we know it today is the breadth of those audiences, right? So that a noir mystery, probably not the same audience as the cookbook, probably not the same audience as your children's book, right? So you start getting real verticalization within a publishing firm. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. Yeah. Amanda, what do you think?
I think that it brings up an interesting other issue about requiring authors to be this sort of rock star that can envision a book in multiple ways, can help provide some of that content, and then, you know, where do you get the enhanced stuff? Do you have them, you know, write the songs that they had mentioned in the book and that kind of thing? So I think that some authors are going to be able to do that, and other authors, they want to write books. They don't want to go on tour or, you know, create the apps that go along with it. So part of the issue will be what are our authors doing, what do they want to do, what do they feel like the book needs or could use. And then we do see a lot of this happening with, Dominique mentioned Harry Potter, when the fans request it and want it, we see them even creating it themselves before sometimes the publishers get around to it. And it is a big monetary investment for the publisher. So it's a sort of a conundrum. We would all love to be able to take every single book and build it to its best potential, but not all of them, not all the audiences want that, not all the authors can do that. So it's I don't see it becoming like every DVD comes with DVD extras. I don't see the books all doing that either.
Well,
we also know that that readers actually don't want all of that stuff, right? So the key in what Richard was saying is to understand your audience well enough to know what it is that they will be interested in versus not, right?
Well, it's interesting, Amanda, that you bring up DVDs. there are those, I imagine, who would argue that the experience of watching a movie should be about the movie as it was actually created, not the deleted scenes, not the add-ons, not the commentaries, that it's that complete package in and of itself. If it was good enough to be released as a movie, that's the complete product. Is that not also the case for many books? That do we really want to know what the alternate ending of Les Miserables was or something like that?
Well, I think you're right that for many movies that's the case, and for many books that's the case. We don't necessarily want to see the making of the 14 romance novels that you read last week, because that's not what you're in it for. So the different readers are reading for different reasons, but there are those books we think about, especially some of the young adult books that have really hit it big, where more is better, Hunger Games, Twilight, all these books where the fans just want to keep living in that realm, and they want to keep doing more and more and finding out more and more. And so it goes back to what do your readers want, and a lot of times they don't want that, but sometimes they really do.
Well, YA is a very specific category, and there are worlds that have been created, and Harry Potter's world is a great example of that, where you want to immerse in that world, and you want to live in that world, and the author may not provide enough content. One of the things that was very interesting was an experiment that somebody tried where they actually created the world and then other writers wrote into that world, right? So it wasn't just one person's take on the world. There were several other people's take on it, which I think is very interesting. That actually was a paranormal romance set I saw.
Hmm. And we've seen other neat experiments, too. I remember Stephen King came out with a book that he released in sort of the manner of Dickens, where it came out as a serial work, and it didn't really work very well because horror and mystery and all those kind of readers, they don't want a piece-by-piece book. They want it all at once. So I can see that there would be a great place for, books produced on Twitter or something, but not all works work for all these cool new experiments.
Right, but the thing that's very interesting is that everything that we're talking about is really the book in almost a translation of the book as it exists today, right? Or of a version of the book that, the Dickens experiment, the way that Dickens published. But we're going to be able to do things with digital books that we have never gotten a chance to do before. So let me give you an example of, there's three of us working in the Shakespeare field right now. And we're all doing roughly, we're not doing the same thing, but we're doing riffs on the same idea. And that is, when you try to read Shakespeare, it's actually fairly difficult for you to do. Craig, I don't know if you remember what it was like learning Shakespeare in school, but, the problem is that you actually don't know the words. And teachers tell us it takes about 3 weeks to get a child to actually start understanding the language of Shakespeare. But today, we're going to be able to embed that dictionary for you. We're going to be able to embed a Shakespearean dictionary so that every time you don't understand a word, you just touch it with your finger and it'll translate the word for you. Now, that is a much easier experience than the physical book. That is actually something that helps you, that cuts down the amount of time it takes for you to immerse in Shakespeare and actually makes it easier for you to learn Shakespeare.
That's an interesting example to cite. I guess the other element with Shakespeare would be it's best to read it aloud. If it's a play, it's meant as a play. And I wonder if technology can provide that as well.
Well, right. Actually, the books that we've been doing, which are Shakespeareans, but there's three. As I said, there are three different publishers working in the field right now. Two of us are working on the plays. One of us is working on the sonnets. And if you go to Shakespeareans, what you're going to see is that we also embedded performances, great performances. So you can hear, you can hear John Gielgud, you can hear Laurence Olivier, you can hear audio of how the play was performed when you download Romeo and Juliet or download Hamlet. And, the point of that experience, though, is that we actually, if you look at the way we started that work, we started by going into classrooms and asking the question, okay, what is the problem that the teacher is having and the student is experiencing when they're trying to learn Shakespeare?
Amanda, Shakespeare aside, what about that personal experience we were talking about before between the author and the reader? I mean, all of these other sorts of bells and whistles can be helpful in terms of learning or with some specifics, but there are plenty of circumstances where it all comes down to the writing on the page and the person reading it.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, when we're talking about what the book is going to look like in the future, I think we have a couple of different paths, and to say that it's all going to be enhanced is probably not true, and to say it's not going to be is another thing. And I think Shakespeare is actually a really good example where they can read that play or sonnet without ever knowing that there was something else to do, and that experience can still be there. But if they stumble on a word that they don't know or a metaphor that they're unfamiliar with, then they can go a little bit further and participate in that enhanced experience. And I think that, you know, with all kinds of reading, there are places where it's appropriate to have something there in the background for you if you want to learn more, but not have that intrude in your experience. And with authors, particularly when they're doing something very creative that maybe needs a little bit more explanation, we see footnotes in novels now that explain some of that stuff. And it can be distracting, you know, where do you pause and learn about that. But in ebooks, we have the opportunity for it to be really up to the reader when they want to go further and delve deeper. So the experience between author and reader, I think, can be very strong and still allow for that interactive experience when the reader is ready and when the reader wants it to happen.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guests are Amanda Gom, co-founder of Digital Bindery in Portland, Oregon, a digital conversion service provider for publishers and authors, and Dominique Rocca, founder and publisher and CEO of Source Books, an independent publisher based in Naperville. She is the immediate past chair of the Book Industry Study Group. We're discussing the state of and future of the book publishing industry, and we welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions and comments on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's go first this morning to Mike in Effingham. Mike, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. Interesting for taking my call. My comments first, or I would ask, do your guests include newspapers in the field of print and learning?
Dominique?
Do we have newspapers in the field of print and learning?
Yes.
Well, we're certainly working in the education field. I mean, that's, you know, where we're doing development work. And as you probably know, there's a tremendous amount of work going on in technology and e-learning. And, you know, I think that was actually one of the points I was going to make next was to, you know, the way that we all learn about a book, about what a book is actually in childhood, right? It's about picture books and textbooks. And then if that changes, then what the book will change with it. But go ahead, I didn't quite understand your question.
Elongated, the homogenization of print and learning, no matter where it's on a computer, a newspaper, a book, those things, in my opinion, appeal to different categories of learning. And what we learn and how we learn it by the power of suggestion, or if the author is appealing to a an upper teenager or to a lower adult, and how that turns on the pivot of learning and how we respond to what we read and what we hear and what we see. I mean, that, to me, the educative process of reading has slackened and has now leveled off some at the teenage level, some who never reach lower adulthood, and it seems to me very few who ever reach upper adulthood. Thanks for taking my call, and I'll ring off.
All right. Thanks, Mike. I guess, and I'll bring Amanda back in on this. I think if I understand Mike correctly, what he's getting at is maybe in the efforts to be more interactive, to reach out to a specific audience in a specific way when we talk about teen fiction or something like that, that maybe we end up with less challenging material, and so that there's sort of a less challenging educational process when that audience, a given audience, is reading a particular kind of book. What do you think?
I've heard that we live in a hyper-literate society, that when we're talking about reading, most of the reading that we do isn't sitting down with a book. And so the stuff that does come out really quickly, the newspapers, blogs, even the material that people are reading in video games and that kind of thing, does tend to be what we end up reading the most. And I think when we're talking about trying to help children become critical readers and have high reading comprehension, we need to remember that they are reading other places other than books and introduce those challenging situations where they can learn more vocabulary and raise the level of reading that's happening there. I think if we ignore it and say you have to limit what your children do or what they read other than in books, then we're gonna miss the mark. And so instead, I like to try to focus on how we can bring that reading experience, a challenging and educational reading experience, to them where they are, in addition to providing the, you know, high quality printed material and published books.
We're taking your questions about the state of books and book publishing for Dominique Rocca, founder, publisher, and CEO of Sourcebooks, an independent publisher based in Naperville, and Amanda Gomm, co-founder of Digital Bindery in Portland, Oregon, a digital conversion service provider for publishers and authors. You can join our conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll take more of your phone calls and emails after a short break. This is Focus.
From the time their son was three, John Schwartz, a national correspondent from the New York Times, and his wife, Jean Mixon, suspected their son was gay. Even though they supported him as he faced difficulties in school fitting in, as a teen, he attempted suicide. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with them about their memoir, Oddly Normal. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Craft League of Champaign-Urbana, presenting their 30th annual Arts and Craft Show on November 10th and 11th at the Urbana Civic Center. Open Saturday 10 to 5 and Sunday 10 to 4. More information is at 367-9546.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing the state of publishing and the future of books with Dominique Rocca, founder, publisher, and CEO of Sourcebooks, an independent publisher based in Naperville. She's the immediate past chair of the Book Industry Study Group. And Amanda Gomm, co-founder of Digital Bindery in Portland, Oregon, a digital conversion service provider for publishers and authors. We welcome you to the conversation. Are you spending more or less money on books today than you used to? Do you prefer physical books or e-books? Can you envision a day when we only ever download books instead of purchasing a physical copy? To join our conversation and share your thoughts on that, or to pose any other questions or comments you have, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You can email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll go next to Helen in Urbana. Hi, Helen. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I recently purchased a tablet for purposes of being able to read ebooks. I took it with me on a trip, but when I got to my destination, the battery was down, and I discovered I had failed to bring a connection. There I was with a totally useless piece of hardware. I mean, this is my biggest problem with e-books. That's the e part of it.
All right. we'll talk about it.
Fortunately, I did have physical books, and I read several of them, as I normally do. But I would really, really, really hate not to be able to have a physical book.
All right. Thanks very much for the comments. Dominique, physical
you
books,
bet.
The batteries don't run down on physical books, do they?
You bet. Totally agree.
Amanda?
But you also just, you know, when you look at why people buy e-books, e-readers, just I suspect like our guest just did, it has a lot to do with being able to carry more than one book, right? So it's very portable and
right.
You can access the book anytime.
Amanda, any thoughts?
Yeah, I had somebody say to me that if for some, in some weird alternate future past, we actually had gone backwards. We started out with e-readers, and then someone invented this amazing new technology called the printed book. We would all drop our e-readers and be so excited that we finally invented something that doesn't need a battery, that is persistent, that we don't lose our bookmarks and all that stuff. So, I mean, there's that idea that it is a pretty good technology already. But then also, I was actually thinking about this morning, e-ink readers take very little power to display, and the tablets take a lot more with the LCD screens. But also, it seems like as battery technology and our ability to maybe use solar energy increases, I think we're going to see that that's one of the big things that happen to e-readers, is that we're going to get e-readers that are solar-powered, that can recharge themselves, that won't ever lose that power. And so, yeah, it's not perfect yet, and we're not there. But I think that is definitely one of those things that we're going to see fixed in the future.
Let's take another call. We have caller from the central Illinois town of Belgium. Good morning. Welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning to you all. And the previous caller just hit exactly on what I was saying. The folks from Connecticut to New Jersey right now, probably not thinking too much about how they're going to power up their e-books, but they could sit there and read a regular book. I being very much of a Luddite, I see this as a definite problem in the future. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks very much for the call. Dominique, any thoughts?
No, I think that Amanda hit it, you know, in terms of what we're working on.
All right, let's go next to Azad in Champaign. Good morning. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you doing?
Well, how are you?
I have a comment on basically the need for more experimentation and pricing models for by publishers for ebooks. It seems like publishers take a view that books are worth a certain amount of money, and that if they publish that book at a certain amount of money or a cheaper amount of money, then that book won't be worth that much. The books are worth what people are willing to pay for them. So if a book's priced at $2, it's worth $2 for all the number of people who are willing to pay $2. Likewise, if it's $20, then there's a smaller number of people who are willing to pay $20 for that ebook. So I mean, so there's a different frustration, I think, among consumers who look at like the pricing of ebooks, and especially the way that the price fixing happened. By some of the bigger publishers, and in a way that was like definitely looking at gouging consumers who are pricing ebooks. So I want to push on publishers to look at bundling ebooks with paper books, like to create value for consumers, and not to believe that your book is priced at $20, so it's worth $20 to all consumers, because that's definitely not true. I think that's just a fundamental error.
Okay, thanks very much for the call. And since we have a publisher on with us, we'll ask Dominique. This reminds me of the process with DVDs, where they started offering you'd have a DVD, and then you could have maybe a Blu-ray disc or maybe a data disc, and you could download a digital file of a given movie. Is the same thing maybe an option for books?
We have, it's great. We have all tried that, I think. Sourcebooks has tried it with a number of our retailers, but I know other publishers have as well. Let me give you the news. Consumers are not interested in buying them. And it is unequivocal, by the way. And I think it's because the people who read e-read-e, right now at least, and the people who read p-books, physical books, read physical books. So it's not really as a reader, you're not experiencing a lack or a need to have the other format available to you. So you actually won't pay for that.
Amanda, what about his other point that the price for a given book really comes down to what the market will bear?
Well, I mean, of course, that is true. But at the same time, I think we have some education to do to the public to make them realize that money and production costs still goes into the production of an ebook. It's still edited. It's still written. It's still produced. The actual design for the ebook still happens, and it has value. We wouldn't say that an MP3 of a song is any less valuable than a song that comes on a CD. It's the same content, and so, you know, we need to give that value. And yeah, I agree that we need some more experimentation, and I think self-publishers are doing a great job with the experimentation with pricing and what happens when you lower a price too low, or how we can really come to that equilibrium for what the value is and what it's worth and how much people are willing to pay. But if we're talking about bundling it with physical books all the time, then we are really reducing the value of the production of that product.
This is Focus. Go ahead, Dominique.
Oh, in a way, it doesn't matter. If the customer doesn't want it, you know, we can bundle all day long. We're willing to, I think, you know, the industry's been very willing to do what the customer wants. One of the things you got to think about is are books worth what people are willing to pay for them? Part of the conversation that we're having here, and the words that we haven't quite said, are agents and authors, right? So we really haven't talked about agents at all, and we haven't talked about sort of the big authors, not the self-published authors. And at some point, you have to think about, you know, how do you create a success of the kind that was Hunger Games, right? So Hunger Games, it took tens of thousands of people to create Hunger Games. So if we don't put those people into that process, what do we have as an outcome? How does it work? I mean, we can certainly do that, but the question is, how does it work?
Let's take another call. We have Dave on the line from Champaign. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, my question is related to the games. It seems to me that there's a growing group of people who get their literacy from engaging in computer games. They used to be able to do things like Monopoly handheld, but could you say something about the gaming industry and how it relates to literacy?
All right. Thanks for the call. Yeah, this is interesting. What do you think, Dominique?
Really interesting, yes. There's actually, and I think you're going to see, and Craig, this comes back to the point you were making about newspapers and magazines. So in a way, all media are sort of converging, right? And games are converging with books in the area of storytelling. And when we talk about transmedia storytelling, which a lot of children's publishers in particular are involved in, which is storytelling through lots of different media, you're seeing games kind of come into that in a very interesting way. And absolutely, people are obtaining their literacy or their way of thinking about stories from games.
We have this email from Camille, who writes, I hope we never reach the point where books are only available in an e-format. I do own a full-color e-reader, and I like using it for reading magazines and fiction, but find it not very user-friendly for my nonfiction reading and research. I mark up nonfiction books with notes in the margins, highlighting, and sticky tabs, which I can do on the e-reader, but when I gather all my nonfiction sources together in preparation for writing, the e-reader fails me. I like to have all the books open in front of me and flip pages back and forth and read paragraphs and pages side by side. I prefer to have my nonfiction books in hard copy on my library shelves. Amanda, this gets back to this idea of there are some types of books, some types of audiences where it makes sense to go the e-route, and then there are some types where the physical pages is really important.
Mm-hmm. And I think there are two things going on. First, e-readers aren't ready for us yet, you know, as far as being able to do that kind of research. Even taking notes is really difficult, and then how do you share those notes or use them in another place? So I think e-readers aren't ready yet. The other thing is that I think there are two visions of the future. One is the Star Trek version, where everyone walks around with tablets and we never see a piece of paper. And the other is the Battlestar Galactica version, where we've got books on the shelves of the captain's bookshelf, and where it's sort of this hybrid. And I think that, I don't think anyone is saying that we're going to get rid of print books. I think it's a really, really great technology, and it's going to persist, and it's going to be used for not only for books as artifacts, but for that time when you want all of your books open at once and you can look back and forth. So, you know, I agree that it's, especially right now, we can't do that. I think in the future we might be able to do something similar, but even like Dominique was saying, our idea of what a book is isn't a fixed thing, and it's going to change, and we're gonna see something new and different that we can't imagine yet.
Dominique, I mentioned that you're the immediate past chair of the Book Industry Study Group. What does that group do?
Well, it's the only place where the whole industry comes together to talk about the ways to really enhance and improve what we call the industry supply chain. So that means things like, you know, right now you're going to see a tremendous amount of conversation around the word discovery, right? So we know, for example, that people are very good at discovering books in bookstores, but are far less good at discovering new books, new authors that they want to read in a digital environment. Now, if we move to the more that digital grows, the more challenging it becomes then to discover new authors, to in fact discover even an existing book by an author that you once knew, which, you know, is something that you stumbled on when you went into a bookstore, right, Craig? So,
right.
So for example, we do a tremendous amount of work in something that we call metadata, which is the data about data, and it is the data about books, and how do we create the right kind of information so that you can stumble upon, if you will, the right book for you. And so BISG, the Book Industry Study Group, works in all of those different kinds of areas, whether it be, you know, Onyx feeds, or how do you get information into an e-retail platform. It also is great at research, so a lot of the data that I was giving early in the conversation were data we have. You know, we know a lot about how this transformation is happening on the ground, which is incredibly important as we plan for the future of the book.
We have an email from a listener in Champaign who says, I'm being forced to think about e-books because the P-books, the physical books, have been so disappointing. If the book doesn't measure up to the hype, I'm going to have to pay much less. And Amanda, this gets back to the question of no matter what's happening with the industry, at the end of the day, there has to be a high-quality product in terms of what's being written. How would you characterize the quality of writing today, the quality of books today, compared to past years, past decades?
I think that what's being produced today is probably the same. The difference is that there's so much more available to us, that discovery, like Dominique was talking about, becomes difficult. We have to sift through the quantity that's being put out there, because it's easier, not only with ebooks, but with print on demand, when you're able to walk into my Powell's bookstore in Portland, and I can go up to a machine, click a button, it'll print a book out for me, and I can walk away. And so more and more and more and more is available, and how do we sift through that? And, you know, social media is playing a part in that. But when it comes down to, I'm not going to buy a book because it's not valuable to me, the same is going to be true with ebook and print book, and we need to realize that we still have to edit our books. We still have to find someone who's going to put forth the best stuff. And as curation, I think publishers still are doing a really good job of, and agents as well, finding the people that are creating the really good content. They're not the only people, and good books still slip through the cracks, and so we're seeing a lot of independent authors coming up with really great stuff on their own and using the resources that they have to edit and produce their own books.
We're going to have to leave it there. I'm afraid we're just out of time, but I want to say thank you to our guests this morning. Amanda Gomes, co-founder of Digital Bindery, based in Portland, Oregon, a company that provides digital conversion services for both publishers and authors. Amanda, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
And Dominic Rocca is founder, publisher, and CEO of Sourcebooks, an independent publisher based in Naperville, Illinois. She's the immediate past chair of the Book Industry Study Group. Dominic Rocca, thank you for talking with us as well.
Thanks, Craig. Thank you very much.
And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, in light of the fact that it will be Election Day and you will probably be very, very weary of the campaign ads and all of the other trappings of the election, we figured you'd probably by tomorrow just want to vote in peace. So we will provide a completely election-free program, and we wanted to come up with a topic that was as far from the reality of Election Day as possible. And so we will, in fact, leave this world behind and use the hour to explore Middle Earth. We'll talk with Corey Olson, better known as the Tolkien Professor. He teaches about J.R.R. Tolkien's writing at the University of Washington, and he has a new book out called Exploring J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit. It's designed as a sort of companion to the classic novel, something to be read side by side, chapter by chapter, which I guess you really maybe couldn't easily do with an ebook, but never mind. With a new big screen adaptation of The Hobbit coming to theaters next month, we couldn't think of a better time to introduce novices to Tolkien's works. And for ringers everywhere, the really serious Tolkien devotees can talk with a scholar who has studied the author and his works in great depth. So that conversation, election-free, will be on tomorrow's program. Today's show was produced by Travis Stanzel. Kyle Mabry's our technical director. He handled your calls. I'm Craig Cohen.